America Trends Podcast is part of the MHNR Network. MHNRnetwork.com.
What you're about to experience is one man's quest to see beyond the tumultuous period we're in and to envision what lies just beyond our grasp, yet well within our reach. Welcome to Larry Rifkin's America Trends, where the future has arrived, and it's just in time.
Welcome back to America Trends. I'm Larry Rifkin. Today, we bust open the myths about poverty, who it affects, how likely most Americans are to ever face it, and whether we have truly engaged in a serious war on poverty. We have new research and new ideas about being poor in America. Listen to this episode and truly inform yourself as to what it's like to have little of what America treasures most, money. That's all today on America Trends.
With me on America Trends is Mark Robert Rank, and he, along with Lawrence Eppard and Heather Bullock, have written a book called Poorly Understood, What America Gets Wrong About Poverty. And what is it? Let's take the lead from you and the book title. What do we get wrong about poverty? And more importantly, why do we get it wrong?
Well, that is a big question, and there is plenty that we get wrong about poverty. So why don't we start with kind of the first thing that we deal with in the book, and that is this myth that poverty will happen to somebody else and it won't happen to me. It turns out that I've been doing a lot of research over the last few years on looking at the overall risk of poverty for Americans. And actually, a majority of Americans at some point in their lives will experience a year below the official poverty line, and three quarters of Americans will experience either poverty or near poverty. So this sort of idea that, oh, poverty happens to somebody else, it's never going to happen to me, is really incorrect. And the reason why, one of the reasons why those percentages are so high is that in the book, we're talking about folks from ages 20 to 75, and that's a long period of time, and things happen to people that they didn't anticipate. So losing a job, family splitting up, getting sick, all of those things have the potential to throw people into poverty. So I think that's a first, you know, really strong myth that's out there. It's going to happen to somebody else. The reality is poverty is a lot closer than you might think.
Absolutely. And in the book, I mean, you describe America in the way that those of us who really kind of look at this with an objective eye have to come to realize that we are not the most generous of nations in terms of our social contract with our citizens. And in fact, when I do any of these reports on my podcast about America and its ranking as it relates to other industrialized nations, we really don't offer a great social safety net.
No, you're exactly right. In fact, we are probably the least generous of any of the high sort of economy countries, you know, the countries in Europe, Canada, Australia, Japan. We have a very minimal safety net and welfare state. And not only that, we also are, as I'm sure you have talked about in the past, we're also very much of an outlier in terms of providing other things that other countries routinely provide, like universal health care or affordable child care or affordable housing. These are things that most countries provide, but the United States does not. And this kind of gets to this question that you were asking at the beginning, which is, well, why not? Why don't we provide these kinds of things, or why don't we address poverty? And I think one really big reason is that we are really steeped in the idea of rugged individualism. And it's the idea that, you know, you do it on your own, you don't depend on others, this kind of thing. And that's really gotten in the way of us addressing some of these issues.
Absolutely. I mean, there's no question about it. And we also look upon it, perhaps, as you say, as us and them, because we have a certain stereotype as to who falls into poverty, and the fact that perhaps we look at their deficiencies and blame it on them.
There's a chapter in the book that talks about the moral ground of viewing poverty. And the way that we have done that in this country is we've used blame, individual blame, as kind of the moral ground to look at poverty, that there's something wrong with you, you're not working hard enough, you made bad decisions, that you're really to blame for being in poverty. And what we argue is that the moral ground needs to shift from individual blame to social injustice, that in a country that has the resources and the wealth that the United States has, there's something fundamentally wrong and unjust about such a high percentage of people in the United States falling into poverty. So the moral sort of framework that we've looked at poverty really needs to shift from individual blame to social injustice.
It's really interesting that those of us who are middle class, we don't recognize, I think, all the goodies that we get and all the benefits, particularly when it relates to home mortgage interest and deductions and a whole range of things that really benefit us. But I really found it interesting. In the book, you talk about a high correlation between falling into poverty and then using a social safety net program. And, of course, during the pandemic, many people, up to $150,000 or more as a couple, getting money from the government. And I don't hear too many people complaining about that. In fact, most people are appreciative of that. But you say that the correlation in that regard, the social safety net program related to you falling into poverty, even if it's for 1 year of your life and you had a really bad year, you had a divorce, you know, who knows what happened. But 65% of the people then got onto a program. But I imagine, and this is just me, Mark, and I don't know whether I'm correct, but that they convinced themselves that they're more worthy than the next guy. In other words, I got into it, but I got out of it, and that was a little handout, but it helped me for the moment, but you know, I didn't need it again.
Yeah. That is exactly right, Larry. I did a number of years ago a book on looking at folks who were on a safety net program. And one of the things I asked them is, you know, why are you using this program? And why do you find yourself in poverty? And most folks would say, I lost my job, my family split up, I got sick, these kinds of things that were really beyond their control. But when I asked them, well, why do you think most people are using these programs? They, 9 out of 10 people said they're lazy, they're not working hard, they're using drugs, variations on this. So it's very much what you're saying. When there's a stigma around a group, what often happens is that group itself buys into the stigma, but they're careful to disassociate themselves and their own situation from that overall stigma. So you see that over and over for particular groups, and that's really the case with poverty. Poverty and welfare use are highly, highly stigmatized in American society, and so people aren't raising a flag and saying, hey, I'm in poverty. No, you know, people want to run away from that, and at the same time, they buy into these overall kind of myths and stereotypes.
Let's break a couple of things down to help somebody listening to this. What is poverty? Because there have been many occasions when I've done a podcast and we've started talking about the poverty levels and the way we have assessed who is in poverty. And it doesn't seem as if America even gets that right in terms of recognizing what it costs to live in 2021.
Yeah. We can think about poverty in a variety of ways, but the way that we've done that in the United States is to basically draw a line in terms of overall household income and say, if you fall below that line, we're going to count you as being in poverty, and if you fall above that line, you won't be counted as in poverty. So for last year, for a family of three, the poverty line was around $20,000. So again, if that household made less than $20,000 during the year, they would be in poverty. Now, as you rightly point out, this is a very, very conservative measure. You know, trying to survive on that amount is really hard. But here is a really interesting point. That represents poverty at its most opulent level. So if you're $1 over that, you're not in poverty. It turns out that 45% of folks in poverty in the United States fall below half the poverty line. So try imagining living on less than $10,000 a year for a family of three. That's impossible, but that's the case for many people. So, you know, sometimes people say, oh, you know, poverty's not so bad in the United States. It's actually really bad, and it's much worse than in many other countries.
Yeah, that's, by the way, in this book, they bust up all kinds of myths, and one of them is that to be poor in America ain't so bad. You know, you've got a TV, and you've got whatever other amenities, you bust that wide open, as you do many things. For example, let's go way back. And let's go back to Lyndon Johnson's War on Poverty. And many people will look at it and say, boy, that was a disaster. It never worked. Look, we still have poverty. And yet you tell us, in fact, it was a success.
Yeah, for sure. So, you know, Ronald Reagan was notorious for saying, we fought a war on poverty and poverty won. And that's been kind of a viewpoint, particularly among conservatives, that the government really can't do much. In fact, it may make the situation worse. Well, that's totally wrong. Poverty in the United States in 1959 was 22%. So 22% of the population were in poverty. By 1973, it was 11%. So poverty had been reduced in half. There are two main reasons for that. One was the war on poverty, which began in 1964. And the other was strong economic growth. Those two factors had a significant effect on reducing poverty. Now, did we eliminate poverty? No, but reducing it by 50% is pretty good. And here's another example of government having a really profound impact on reducing poverty. In 1959, the poverty rate for the elderly in this country was around 35%. Today, it's around 9 or 10%. And there's only one reason why that has dropped like that: Social Security and Medicare. Those two programs have been remarkably effective in reducing poverty for the elderly. The estimate is that if there were no Social Security today, the poverty rate for the elderly would go from 10% to around 40%. So the idea that government cannot address poverty is flat out wrong.
And of course, these programs, once they're implemented, they never go away. I mean, these kinds of social service programs are now a bedrock here in the United States. Imagine, we've had this debate about even privatizing Social Security, and the uproar from those of us who are a little bit older, and now the baby boomers, nobody wants to give up anything because these are so baseline important to so many individuals. And that's why I'd love to bring you to the current debate over the minimum wage. And I think a lot of people look at it and say, well, minimum wage is what I made when I worked at the amusement park when I was 16. Now, I have argued, and Mark, tell me, because you're an expert on this issue of poverty inequality, I've always said, well, when I was on radio and even on the podcast, I wouldn't mind a sub-minimum wage for a 16-year-old to work at a seasonal job. But I do want to recognize how many people are working minimum wage jobs trying to support a family, and oftentimes multiple jobs to do that.
Yeah, excellent point. So what's happened in the United States over the last 40 or 50 years is that we've been producing more and more low-wage jobs. So these are jobs that don't pay very much. They don't have benefits attached to them. And folks just can't survive on those kinds of jobs. It turns out that today, about 40% of people who are working in what is considered a low-wage job, which is below $16 an hour. So if you're working at $8, $9, $10 an hour, by definition, you're going to be in poverty. And I think that, you know, the argument here, which President Biden has made, is that if you're working full time in America, you shouldn't still be in poverty. And one way to address that is to raise the minimum wage up to a more of a livable wage. And so this would affect, this isn't, we're not just talking about, you know, 16-year-olds here. We're talking about a significant, as I said, 40% of the population is working at jobs that are considered low wage. So getting that minimum wage up is really important, and then indexing it so that it keeps up with inflation each year is even more important, because what happens is we raise the minimum wage and then nothing happens for 10 years. This is what's happened now. The last time minimum wage was raised was in 2009 to $7.25. We should do with minimum wage the same thing we do with Social Security, which is index it to inflation so that each year it keeps up with the cost of living.
And what about the notion, because if people think, oh, we're not going to be able to hire that kid for the summer, and it's really important for that kid to get that job. All of us learned a lot about our work ability and our work skills just by starting out at 16. About a sub-minimum wage for, say, a young person working mm-hmm. just for the summer seasonally, would that help in the
yeah.
debate about this?
Yeah, I think it would, because I think what you're pointing out is a lot of people would feel the same way. And so, yeah, thinking about, you know, for teenagers, you know, a summer job, maybe we ought to think about this a little bit differently. And I think that's fine. But again, you know, the majority of raising the minimum wage would definitely help the majority of adults. So many of these folks are, you know, in their 20s, 30s, or 40s. But I think that's a good idea.
Let's talk about child poverty as part of the.
Yeah.
There's so many aspects to it. We've got about 10 million American children living in poverty. And I know that Joe Biden has a plan as a corrective for this. Mitt Romney has put forward a permanent benefit along with a package of tax increases, spending cuts to pay for it, to help us with the child tax credit. How important is that to families?
So that's really, it's really interesting that both President Biden and Senator Romney have proposed a child allowance. The idea there is that if you have a child, we're going to give you some kind of assistance on a monthly basis, you know, $400 or $500 a month to help raise that child. That's actually, you know, for the United States, that's a pretty radical policy. Child allowances have been around in Europe for decades. That's just routine. But the idea there is that it's really important to invest in children. And here's something that I think your listeners would find interesting. I tried to, a couple years ago with a graduate student here, we tried to attempt to measure what the economic cost of childhood poverty in the United States is. So we know that children in poverty have higher health care costs. We know that when they're adults, they won't be as economically productive because we haven't invested in their education and things like that. And we know that there's higher criminal justice costs associated with poverty. So we factored all those things in. And what we came up with was the childhood poverty costs the United States on an annual basis slightly over $1 trillion. So to put that into perspective, that was about 28% of the entire federal budget. So it's not as if we're not paying for this, but we're paying for it on the back end of the problem rather than the front end of the problem, which is always more expensive. So something like a child allowance addresses the issue on the front end of the problem. The other thing that we found, which I think is important, is that for every dollar we would spend reducing childhood poverty, say through a child allowance, we would save between $7 and $12 down the road in preventing these costs. So not only is preventing childhood poverty the morally right thing to do, it's also economically the smart thing to do.
When we look at all of the factors that contribute to poverty, if we look at housing costs, if we look at education, if we look at child care, which I think a lot of people are talking now about the back end of the process when a lot of us have accumulated more wealth and more income in terms of trying to help kids get to college. why am I more concerned about trying to get them into preschool, get them a good head start, and making that part of the early childhood package that is even more important, perhaps, than later on when many families are in a better situation than when they're starting out?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's this idea of, you know, being penny wise and pound foolish, of trying to think about only the short term and not the long term kind of gain. But you know, let me bring up a point here that I think is relevant to what we're talking about, and that is that, you know, in the United States, as we talked about earlier, that poverty is often thought about as an individual failing. You know, again, that people are doing something wrong. And one of the big arguments we make in the book is that really poverty is a structural failing. It's a failing on the economic level and on the political levels. And the way that I think makes this, you know, kind of brings this to life is this analogy that we use in the book about musical chairs. You know, picture a game of musical chairs, and we have, you know, 10 players and 8 chairs. They circle around, the music stops, 2 people lose out. Well, who's going to lose out? Well, it's going to be somebody who's not as fast, not as agile, bad position when the music stopped. And we can point to those reasons for why those 2 people lost out. But if we step back and say, wait a minute, the structure of the game is set up such that 2 people are going to lose out, then those characteristics only explain who the losers are, not why the game produces losers in the first place. And that's what we've been doing in this country. We focus on the characteristics of who is in poverty as opposed to the structure of the game, which says there aren't enough decent paying jobs. And as you just said, there isn't enough affordable child care, and we don't provide universal health care. Given that situation, 2 people are going to lose out. And so by focusing just on their characteristics, we do nothing to change the structure of the game. And that's what we really need to do in this country. We need policies that change the structure of the game rather than just who loses out.
Mark Robert Rank is with us. Poorly Understood is the book, What America Gets Wrong About Poverty. And let's cut through it to a very important issue that to this point we really haven't discussed. And that is the fact that when you go back and you look at America, and we're starting to do some self-analysis today, black and white issues clearly have dominated our entire history. So when we try to answer the question, who are the poor, it's perceived as a them versus us issue, black or Hispanics on one side, whites on the other. But that, too, is a total myth.
And this is a really important point, that in the United States, we have often viewed poverty through the lens of race. On one hand, it definitely is the case that if you're a person of color, you're more likely to experience poverty. But the largest group in poverty are actually white Americans. And the reason is because they're a larger percentage of the overall population. This issue of race has really served to, as you said, to sort of set this up as a dynamic of them versus us. And what we need to do is we need to see that poverty affects us all. You know, race has been used over and over in this country to divide poor whites and poor blacks from seeing their common interests. And I'll give you one quote. This was from President Lyndon Johnson in 1960. He was talking to an aide. And he said, "I'll tell you what's at the bottom of it. If you can convince the lowest white man that he's better than the best colored man, he won't notice you picking his pocket. Hell, give him somebody to look down on, and he'll empty his pockets for you." And that's what we've been doing in this country over and over, and politicians have been playing on that, particularly in the South, over and over again. And we need to get beyond that. Instead of seeing poverty as, oh, it's an issue of somebody of a different color, no, it's an issue for all of us. But I think that you raise a really important point, that race has often been used to divide us rather than to unite us.
And what are we seeing today? Because there is such anger among lower income whites in rural areas where jobs have really vanished. Mm-hmm. We've seen zip codes vanish in many places because a manufacturing plant left. And I know we talk about it in the context of manufacturing jobs, but there is really this resentment that has built up. And then, of course, they look upon anyone else perhaps who is in a similar situation, and they try to, look at themselves and say, this can't be happening to me, or, they don't like the status that they are given. Because let's be honest about it, Mark, in our society, money really is the currency. Money is the room color and the room temperature for America.
I think you're exactly right that many, many folks in rural America, sort of white working class folks, have felt that, they're working hard, but they're not getting ahead. And they're right. Median male wages in 1973, once you control for inflation, were higher than they are today. People are not getting ahead. And that's what Trump tied into, this sort of anger of I'm not getting ahead. But what he did is he directed it to the wrong cause. It's not because of some other group or some immigrant group coming in. It's because of these economic kinds of changes that have happened over the last 40 or 50 years. The fact that, jobs have left the United States, manufacturing jobs. The fact, as we talked about earlier, that we're producing more and more low-wage jobs. It's a structural problem, and that's what we need to address. But Trump, definitely tied, and actually so did Bernie Sanders in 2016, tied into this anger of not getting ahead. But again, Trump sort of directed it to the wrong cause. And you often will see that in tough economic times, is that there's a blaming of some group. There's a blaming of immigrants. There's a blaming of folks of color for these problems. When really that's not the source of the problem. The source of the problem is both economic and political.
Yeah, and I'm wondering with the pandemic economy, what I saw when I went out with my double masks and reluctantly is that on the front lines of America, and I live in the state of Connecticut, I see black and brown people performing a lot of the frontline work. They're the most visible to me in many cases when I'm going shopping as quickly as I can. Will the pandemic poverty that a lot of people have now suffered or the ways that they have been deprived during this period, is there a possibility that we might look at this issue a little bit differently going forward?
Yeah, I think there is a possibility. When we've had changes in this country in terms of policy and poverty, it's been the result of kind of large structural problems and failings. So the New Deal, obviously came about in the 1930s because of the Great Depression. The war on poverty in the 1960s was partially the result of real sort of economic and racial turmoil during that time. So what the pandemic shows is, again, that this is a structural issue. This is not people not wanting to work hard or something. It has nothing to do with that. It has to do with a structural problem. In this case, the pandemic, which is really hitting the economy really, really hard. So I think there is the possibility of kind of rethinking this, and I'm guardedly optimistic. I think with the new administration, there is talk about these issues. As we talked about earlier, there's talk about a child allowance. There's more and more talk now about the idea of a universal basic income, which, a few years ago would be just like, what are you talking about? And today, in at least the progressive wing of the Democratic Party, people are talking about these kinds of things. Well, that's, again, kind of looking at poverty from a more structural perspective rather than, oh, there's something wrong with what you're doing. So I'm actually guardedly optimistic that I think we're going to see some important changes in the next, in the next few years that will be more effective in terms of thinking about poverty.
Well, one of my guests recently, who wrote a book called Republic of Wrath, reminded me that it was Richard Nixon who came up with the idea of universal basic income at the urging, I think, of Milton Friedman. Yeah. So, this has been a conservative idea. But I want to ask you in that context about welfare and welfare reform. That was the buzzword in the 1990s. Where are we today? And how effective is welfare, or the welfare that we now offer?
We talk about in the book, you know, the welfare state in the United States is very, very minimal. So as you noted, you know, Bill Clinton, you know, famously ran on this idea of we're going to end welfare as we know it. And in 1996, you know, really had some pretty dramatic changes in terms of welfare. Now, conservatives will say, oh, that was a big success because the welfare rolls went down. Well, if you look at poverty, it wasn't a success. It didn't reduce the extent of poverty. What it did is it made it more difficult for people to get on these programs. So, you know, today, what a lot of times people think of as welfare is the TANF program, which is really designed for single moms with kids. That's very, very small today in terms of people getting that program. You know, and the same thing is true with food stamps, the SNAP program, and these kinds of things. Basically what we do in this country is, rather than trying to protect people from falling into poverty, we punish people for falling into poverty, and we punish them by making these programs highly stigmatized and very, very, the opposite of generous. I'm very, very stingy is the way that we kind of do this. So again, we need to kind of go beyond that idea. Rather than punish people in poverty, what we need to do is prevent people from falling into poverty, and economically we'll be much better off. I have a friend here who, an economist, who has shown that, you know, and we haven't really talked about inequality, but as inequality really rises, it actually reduces the productivity of the economy for a variety of reasons. And so investing in people is really a good strategy for economic growth in the future.
By the way, the TANF program, just for people listening, temporary assistance to needy families. I do want to ask you, you kind of got me, because I was just about to go on to income inequality and how extensive that is. When I hear people talking about the tax cuts that were put forward in 2017, and that 83% of the benefits went to 1% of the population, and I've had other guests who've come on to explain that this has been a 40-year march to get more benefit to those who perhaps need it least in our society, thus leading to a point where I think it's three individuals actually have as much wealth in America as the bottom 50%. I mean, these numbers are just so startling and so revealing about the way our society looks at things. And how do we even begin to make a dent in what we have done over the last 40 years?
Inequality has risen, you know, pretty dramatically over the last 40, 45 years in this country. And the statistics that you're pointing out are certainly, you know, right on target. And the other thing that you'll sometimes hear from conservatives will be to say, well, you know, inequality isn't such a bad thing as long as people are able to move up and down, economic mobility. It turns out that there's less economic mobility now in the United States than in many other countries. The other way to think about this is, each generation able to do economically better than the prior generation? That's been one of the kind of tenets of the American dream, that each generation is able to do better. And so for children born in the 1940s, almost all of them did better than their parents. But that has been declining. And so children now in the 1980s, only about half will do better than their parents did. This has become, as you point out, more and more of a problem. What can we do about it? You know, this is really difficult. But, you know, I would say, you know, we need to think about higher taxes on the top end. All the economic gains in the last 40 years have really gone to the top 10, 5, and 1%. To say that, you know, they need to start contributing more to sort of the general coffers is I think definitely justified. So, you know, we could think about that. We can think about, you know, we need to invest more in the education, and particularly of low-income children. I think there's a whole range of policies that we could think about that would start to change that kind of trend in inequality.
Well, what I think is so important about your book is that it describes all these myths that we have about poverty. And we also have a myth about America, which is, well, that the American dream is still alive and well. And as you point out, It's not that well. In fact, it sounds like we've exported it to other countries, and we're not maintaining it for ourselves. The other thing that we tell ourselves is that the playing field is even in America.
Yeah.
Everybody starts off with the same opportunities. And you point out very decisively in the book, it is uneven in the U.S. And you got to look at housing, education, a whole range of things. So we have got a lot of structural issues, as you say, that we have to get in order to actually begin to imagine that which we attribute to ourselves.
Exactly right, that we like to think that the playing field is level, that this is a meritocracy, that you get kind of what you deserve. And we use another analogy that I think is helpful, and it's the game of Monopoly. And so rather than, you know, we think of Monopoly, we have three players, they circle around, you know, and luck and skill are involved. But let's imagine a game of Monopoly where player one has $5,000, player two has $1,500, and player three has $250. Now, who's going to win and lose at the game? We're going to play by the same rules. But given those advantages, player one, even if they're not as lucky or not as skilled, they're going to win almost all of those games. And that's what's happening in the United States. We've got a few players who are player one. We've got a lot of people at player two and a growing number of folks that are player three. And the result is that player one is going to win almost all those games. And that's the way that life is being played. And what we need to do is, again, to even out some of those prior advantages that are simply, you know, it's simply not right, simply not just.
Let me get to one myth and close out our conversation and then encourage people to do some reading and starting with your book. But one other myth is the inevitability of poverty. It's not inevitable.
Right. It certainly is not inevitable. I mean, this goes back, you know, 2,000 years to biblical times, this saying, you know, you'll have the poor with you always. No, it's not inevitable. And as we talked about before, we reduce poverty for the elderly dramatically. We can look across countries and see some countries, you know, the Germany, the Netherlands, France, the Scandinavian countries, that have very low rates of poverty, whereas a country like the United States has high rates of poverty. This is not at all inevitable. It's because countries are very proactive in terms of reducing the number of folks in poverty. So there's lots of things that we can do, and that's the hopeful thing about all this is that poverty is not inevitable. This is not some kind of act of nature. This is a result of economics, of policy, and therefore we can really do something to address this. So I it's good to end on that kind of optimistic note, I think.
Absolutely. Well, really an incredible book, and if you want to make some arguments with friends who tell you that all these myths are true, start with this: poorly understood, what America gets wrong about poverty. Our guest has been Mark Rank. He wrote the book with Lawrence Eppard and Heather Bullock. And I want to thank you so much for being with us today on America Trends.
Oh, thanks, Larry. I really, really enjoyed our conversation. Thank you.